It's time for justice. Welcome to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, heard every Wednesday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. on 97.3 FM WRIR. I'm your host, Marty Wegbright. This show is written and produced by Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. We give free, civil, non-criminal legal aid to low-income people in Richmond, Petersburg, Charlottesville, and surrounding cities and counties. Coming up on this week's show...
One of the hardest things to do in the Virginia General Assembly is actually get a bill passed. They say it's 10 times easier to kill a bill than it is to get one passed. And you do that through good old-fashioned lobbying. That can take many forms. It can be one-on-one lobbying, meeting with each legislator in their office or at their home office, getting people who support the bill you want to get passed to contact those legislators for you, either in person, on the phone, through email, or a letter, what we call grassroots lobbying.
Mark Braley, the executive director of the Legal Services Corporation of Virginia, tells us how a bill really becomes a law in the Virginia General Assembly. And during this week's question and answer session, we explore the similarities and important differences between Social Security disability and SSI disability. All that and more coming up. Stay with us. The show is supported in part by a grant from the Virginia Law Foundation. This show, number 125, is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society and gives only general legal information. If you have a legal problem and need specific legal advice about your situation, contact an attorney. If you can't afford an attorney, we'll tell you later in the show how to get free legal advice or representation in a civil case. The Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show is heard every Wednesday at 12:30 on WRIR, 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio, and is made possible by community radio volunteers at WRIR. And now, this week's news you can use. Last week, new bank account garnishment rules took effect. Under these new rules, a bank that receives a garnishment summons first must determine if the United States or a state child support enforcement agency had the summons issued. If so, the bank follows its usual procedures for handling the summons. If not, the bank must review the account history for the prior 2 months, called the look-back period, to see whether one or more exempt federal benefit payments were directly deposited to the account. Exempt federal benefits includes Social Security, SSI, Veterans Affairs, Railroad Retirement, Railroad Unemployment Insurance, and federal pension benefits. The bank must allow access to an amount called the protected amount, equal to the smaller of the following: the sum of exempt federal benefits directly deposited to the account during the look-back period, or the balance in the account on the date of the account review. In addition, the bank must notify you that they have received a garnishment summons. The notice must briefly explain what a garnishment is and must also include other information about your rights. For an account containing a protected amount, the bank may not collect a garnishment fee from the protected amount and may only collect a garnishment fee from funds in excess of the protected amount. In other news, the Governor's Foreclosure Task Force met last month to listen to presentations on the foreclosure process in Virginia and the legislative proposals to change the notice given to homeowners before foreclosure. Two speakers, John Ryan and John Pendergast, from the Conference of State Bank Supervisors, offered some shocking testimony. They had many damning comments about how mortgage services were doing, noting woefully inadequate staffing, lack of accountability, poor documentation, significant violations of loan modification guidelines, and a business model built for speed and volume only. They observed that by now you would think they would have ramped up their staffs and that at some point in time there should be a pause in dual tracking, that is, processing both a loan modification and a foreclosure at the same time. Finally, they discussed an investigation of the servicers, saying they had randomly reviewed several loan files from different servicers and found 71% had missing assignments, 73% were missing affidavits, 3% were missing the loan notes, and 2% were missing the mortgage. With this week's News You Can Use, this is your host, Marty Wegbright. You're listening to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio.
This week's case that changed the Commonwealth is George Roberecht Seafood Incorporated versus Maitland Brothers. The seafood company bought a defective airplane, as is. The buyer claimed that the seller had represented that all inspections required by law had been made and that the airplane was in perfect condition, that such representations were false, that the seller knew they were false, that the seller made them to induce the buyer to purchase the aircraft, and that the buyer relied upon the representations in making the purchase. The circuit court held that the written contract of an as-is sale prevented any recovery. The Supreme Court of Virginia reversed, saying that a false representation of a material fact, which induces the contract on which the purchaser had the right to rely, is always grounds to rescind a contract. The court also ruled that a buyer can show that a contract of sale was induced by the seller's fraud, even though the sale was made as is. This has been the law ever since. For the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, I'm Diane Dussault. And George Roberecht Seafood Incorporated versus Maitland Brothers is this week's case that changed the Commonwealth.
It's time once again for this week's question and answer. We're here in the studio with this week's questioner. Could you tell us your name and where you're from?
My name is Vita from Henrico County.
Welcome to the show, Vita. What question do we have this week?
My question is about Social Security disability benefits. I was wondering if you have never applied for disability and you haven't worked enough hours to qualify for it because you've had the disability since before you were working age, would you still be able to qualify for disability benefits?
Well, that is an excellent question. And what it does is it highlights the difference between Social Security disability benefits and SSI, or Supplemental Security Income, disability benefits. Social Security is like an insurance program. You worked long enough and recently enough to qualify for benefits. SSI, on the other hand, is like a welfare program. You don't need to have worked a day in your life to get SSI disability benefits. There's another really important difference. Social Security is paid without any regard to need. So you can be Bill Gates, and if you reach retirement age or you become disabled, you get Social Security benefits regardless of your need. SSI is paid strictly on the basis of need. You have to be low income or low resource in order to qualify for SSI disability benefits. Now, I mentioned earlier that Social Security is like an insurance program. You do have to have worked long enough and recently enough to qualify for benefits. What that means is you have to be both fully insured and currently insured. Fully insured means you've worked for 40 calendar quarters. That means 10 years. They don't have to be all together, but that means 10 years. If you are a younger worker, particularly under the age of 28, the rules are slightly different. You need not have worked quite that many quarters, but generally you have to have worked 40 quarters. That's fully insured. Then you have to be currently insured. Currently insured means you've worked 20 out of the previous 40 calendar quarters. In other words, 5 out of the past 10 years. Again, the quarters and the years don't have to be consecutive, but if you look back over the prior 10 years, you have to have worked during 5 of those years. That makes you currently insured. And again, there are slightly different rules for people who are under the age of 28. That's for Social Security. But if you don't meet those rules, you haven't worked long enough or recently enough, you still can apply for SSI disability benefits because you don't have to have worked much or at all to qualify. So no one should feel discouraged in applying for disability benefits because they've never worked. There's a program for them. Is this helpful to you?
Yes, very much so.
Thank you so much for being on the show. We're here at the Legal Services Corporation of Virginia, and we are speaking with Mark Braley, who is the Executive Director. And since last month, the Virginia General Assembly ended its 2011 session, we thought it would be a good idea to talk about how a bill really becomes a law. Welcome to the show, Mark.
Thank you. Nice to be here, Marty.
Now, we all have the cartoon vision of how a bill becomes a law in theory, but in practice, I gather it's quite different. And Virginia has a short session in some years. It has a, quote, long session in other years. Would you just explain the background of the Virginia legislature?
The Virginia legislature meets every year, starting at the second Wednesday in January. And in even years, goes for 60 days, and in odd years, goes 45 days. The reason for that is that the 60-day longer session in even years is the year they develop their two-year budget. The odd year, they're not allowed to create a new budget. They just amend the budget they created the previous year. So they determined at some point they could use a shorter session.
Now, Virginia is a fairly large state. It's about, what, 12th largest in the country. How does the General Assembly get it all done in that short a period of time with thousands of bills and resolutions?
Sometimes I wonder that myself, but the short answer is through a committee system so that bills are quickly vetted through subcommittees and committees before they get to the floor to be voted on by the larger bodies, the House of Delegates or the Senate.
So lead us through the process. Obviously, bills have to be written beforehand and introduced in either the House of Delegates or the Virginia State Senate. So how does this all start?
The best way to explain is probably to tell you what I would go through if I wanted a bill filed, say, to improve funding for legal aid. I, first of all, would draft language for the bill myself, what I want the law to say if it gets enacted or adopted by the General Assembly. I then seek out a sponsor. Every bill has to have at least one sponsor. You can go to the Senate and seek a senator to sponsor your bill. You can go to the House and seek a delegate to sponsor your bill. You can have two versions of the same bill, one with a Senate sponsor and one with a delegate sponsor, have them filed in each House working towards each other in the middle.
What happens after a bill gets filed?
Once the bill is filed by the sponsor, you then start the work of getting that bill passed, which is one of the hardest things to do in the Virginia General Assembly, is actually get a bill passed. They say it's 10 times easier to kill a bill than it is to get one passed. And you do that through good old-fashioned lobbying. That can take the many forms. It can be one-on-one lobbying, meeting with each legislator in their office or at their home office, getting people who support the bill you want to get passed to contact those legislators for you, either in person, on the phone, through email, or a letter, what we call grassroots lobbying. Getting all the people in the state who support what you're doing to work on your behalf towards passage of the bill.
Now, you mentioned a committee and subcommittee system. Could you describe what happens to a bill after it's filed in either the state Senate or the House of Delegates and how it goes through that committee-subcommittee system?
Once the bill is filed, it will be assigned to a committee which covers the area of interest that is in the bill. For instance, if I've got a bill that would increase the filing fee that funds legal aid, it would go to the House Courts of Justice Committee. They govern most of the things that occur within the legal or judicial system. It would also go to the same committee in the Senate, the Senate Courts Committee.
Now, who decides which committee or subcommittee a particular bill gets directed to, especially if it arguably could go to two or more committees or subcommittees?
Right. In the House, the Speaker of the House assigns the bills to committees. In the Senate, the leader in the Senate assigns the bills to the committees.
And is there any recourse if someone believes that the wrong committee or wrong subcommittee has been assigned the bill?
Yes. Your sponsor can make a direct appeal to the person who assigned the bill and say, this is inappropriate, it belongs here or there. Or they can argue germaneness right in the committee and ask the committee chair to take a vote of the committee to re-refer the bill to another committee that may be more appropriate. The way it gets to a subcommittee is once it gets referred to the committee then has various subcommittees that deal with particular issues within the bailiwick of the full committee. So there may be two subcommittees, four subcommittees. Your bill will get assigned to one of those subcommittees. Generally, the subcommittee will be a third or half of the committee members who will finally be voting on the bill.
And again, who makes that decision to assign from committee to subcommittee? And again, is there any recourse if it goes to the wrong subcommittee?
Well, the chair of the full committee makes the assignment of the bill to the subcommittee. And there would, I don't know of many instances where it would go to the wrong subcommittee because the lines of demarcation are very clear. For instance, on the House Courts of Justice Committee, there's a criminal subcommittee and a civil subcommittee. Any bill that I would deal with would go to a civil subcommittee.
Okay, so it's finally made it to the subcommittee. What happens there?
We make a list of the committee, determine who we're going to go meet with, what our message is going to be to them about why this bill is important, meet with them individually, get our contacts from around the state to be contacting these people at the same time with the message that you've developed to help support your bill, and work them. It's called lobbying, and try to convince them that it's worth voting for this bill. Now, you find out in that first meeting where people are, whether they're going to support the bill, whether they are on the fence, or whether they're inclined not to support the bill. And then from there, you determine who needs the work. If you've got a commitment from a legislator in the subcommittee early on that they'll support your bill, you can focus more on the folks who haven't decided where they're going to come down in their vote on the bill or the folks who are against it. And we never give up working either of those, including the ones who are against the bill.
Now, I gather if a bill is approved by a subcommittee, it'll go to the full committee and the same process gets repeated there?
Right. The subcommittee makes a recommendation to the full committee, i.e., the subcommittee voted 5-3 to recommend reporting this bill out of full committee. Or the subcommittee voted 5-3 against reporting this bill out of subcommittee. That's how it comes to the full committee. And then the full committee will then make a determination whether the bill will actually report out of the committee.
And I gather again, if it's approved by the committee, then it will go either to the full House of Delegates or the full State Senate, depending upon which side of the Capitol the bill is on at that particular moment.
That's generally the case, although, and this is another difficulty of getting a bill passed, if your bill has any kind of revenue impact, i.e., if it's going to cost some money, then it gets re-referred from the committee you're in, say Courts of Justice, to the Appropriations or Finance Committee, and then it has to then go through another subcommittee of that committee, the full committee, and then it may or may not be reported to the floor of the House or the floor of the Senate for a full vote.
And what happens if a bill is killed by a subcommittee or killed by a committee? It's not reported out favorably. Is that the end, or is there any possible way to revive that bill?
There are procedural ways to try and revive a bill, and I have done that before with the help of legislators. And what you need to do once a bill's been killed is get a legislator who voted against your bill to make a motion in the next committee meeting to reconsider the bill. The committee votes on that motion to reconsider, and if you're successful and they agree to reconsider it, then you can get another vote on the bill. Once you get a bill through committee and then you get it to the floor, it goes through three votes on the floor of the House or the Senate, three consecutive days. If it passes by a majority in the House or the Senate, you then basically take a breath with that bill until what they call crossover. Halfway through the session, each House has to complete work on their own bills, bills that originated either in the House or the Senate. After crossover day, they can only consider bills that were passed by the other House. So after crossover day, the Senate only looks at House bills, and the House only looks at Senate bills that have already passed.
Now, when the Senate is looking at House bills, are they allowed to change them, or is it a straight up or down on what the other body did?
Absolutely, they can change them. They go through the same committee process on the other side. So after you've been through three or four committee hearings on the House side, gotten it through the House, now you're over in the Senate, you've got to go through the same committee, subcommittee process to get your bill to the floor. During that process, any legislator can offer an amendment to your bill.
So I gather it's possible, indeed probable, indeed likely, that if a bill gets through both bodies, it will be in somewhat different forms. What happens next?
If you have a bill that started out in the House and the same language in a Senate bill, and you had them working towards each other on crossover day, and then the Senate bill goes over to the House and gets amended over in the House, and the House bill goes over to the Senate and gets some minor amendments on it in the Senate, you then have a conflict in the bills that you started. They go into what's called a committee conference or conference committee. And there, the differences in the two bills that were passed by each House are resolved by the conference committee.
And then after they're resolved, what does the bill have to go back to? Both of the houses to be passed again?
Yes. Each, because the resolution, or what they call the conference report, goes to each House to be approved by the full House or full Senate.
And does that also require three votes on three consecutive days in each House?
No, the conference report only requires one vote.
So I gather for a bill to get through the General Assembly, it's got to be approved three times by the House, three times by the Senate, and then in most cases an additional time by the House and an additional time by the Senate.
That is pretty accurate, yes.
So you started by saying it is so much easier to kill a bill than it is to pass one, and obviously your explanation has shown that to be the case. So in terms of the lives of ordinary citizens, and certainly in the lives of legal aid clients that obviously we try to serve and LSCV tries to fund us to serve, how important is this legislative advocacy?
It's very important, and even though my office focuses on the funding piece for legal aid programs, we have legal aid lawyers at the General Assembly working on bills in the same way that I do on funding bills, but that affect our clients substantively, i.e., changes in foreclosure law, changes in housing law, landlord-tenant law, consumer law. And we often get bills filed by our sponsors that try to improve the law for our clients. And we spend a lot of time fighting bills that are obviously bad policy for low-income Virginians.
Thank you so much. We have been speaking with Mark Braley. He is the Executive Director of the Legal Services Corporation of Virginia, and we have been talking about how a bill really becomes a law in Virginia. Thank you so much for being on the show, Mark.
My pleasure. Thank you.
This week's Strange But True Law is from Title 12.1, which deals with the State Corporation Commission. The State Corporation Commission regulates corporations in Virginia, including banks, insurance companies, and public utilities. But did you know they can put people in jail? It's true. Under Code of Virginia 12.1-34, any person summoned to appear and testify before the commission who fails or refuses to appear and testify, or who refuses to answer any proper question, or who conducts himself in a rude, disrespectful, or disorderly manner before the commission can be fined up to $1,000 or jail for up to 6 months. The reason is that the State Corporation Commission was created by Article 9 of the Virginia Constitution for the protection of the public. However, there are no reported instances of this power ever having been used. For the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, I'm Michelle King, and that's this week's Strange But True Law.
That's all for this week's Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. This show is heard every Wednesday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. The show is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. To see if you can get free civil legal aid, call during intake hours. These are Monday through Thursday, 9 a.m. to 11:30 a.m. and 1 p.m. to 2:30 p.m. The phone number is 200-6046 for intake, 648-1012 for the main number, and 1-800-868-1012 to call toll-free. If you have any comments on the show, you can email them to marty@cvlas.org. In addition, every first-run Central Virginia Legal Aid radio show ever broadcast is now available at www.radioforall.net. That's radio, the numeral 4, all.net. Then click the contributor link, then click Marty Wegbright, Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. This show provides only general legal information. If you have a legal problem and need specific legal advice about your situation, contact an attorney. If you can't afford one, call Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. For 50 years, the Virginia Trial Lawyers Association has preserved and protected justice for all Virginians. Join us next Wednesday at 12:30 when Jack Harris, Executive Director of the Virginia Trial Lawyers Association, discusses how his organization tries to make the law better for trial attorneys and for the client they represent. That's Law for the Rest of Us next week on the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. I'm Marty Wegbright.